So she comes in holding his head. Now notice the psychological dynamics here. You may not be familiar enough with this to follow it consciously. Agave is the daughter of Cadmus. She is the mother of Pentheus. Very often the way in which we relate to the children is cognate to the way in which we relate to our own parents. A father to a son, a mother to a daughter. Very often there's that kind of a cognate sense. If the line is kept in natural tact, the father to the daughter to the grandson, then the natural order is strongest. The mythic imagery is dominant. But if one jumps from grandson to grandfather, jumps over the intervening stage of the mother, then one enters into the stronger realm of psychic, symbolic value. And rather than the natural order with its mythic image being predominant, then the psychic consciousness with its symbolic element will be dominant. This is not only true of so-called civilized people, but it's true of any human population. The American Indians, for spiritual values, always address the earth as the grandmother, always address the sky as the grandfather, not as the mother, not as the father, because it is a symbolic value of consciousness and not just a natural value of mythic dimension, but a superior spiritual value that comes from a symbolic relationship. One has the right to ask for healing in a natural sense from your mother or your father, or delegations thereof, but one has the necessity to ask for spiritual help from the grandmother, from the grandfather, from the symbolic dimension of one's existence, the parent of one's parent. One goes to a higher source. One goes to a metaphorical parent. And there, the spiritual energy is dominant and not the natural energy. You can see that in societies where the grandparents are separated from the children by social structure, that it's already a disease structure, already is impaired. To separate the old from the young is sociological hubris in a vast order. So she holds up, "Father, look what I have. See here what I carry in my arms. This is the prize I won. I have brought it to hang on your palace wall. Take it, Father, hold it, be proud of my hunting, and call your friends to a banquet. Let them all envy and congratulate you for the splendor of my deed." Cadmus. O anguish unmeasured, intolerable, O pitiful hands, your splendid deed is murder. What victim is this you would lay at the gods' feet, calling Thebes and me to a banquet? Your suffering is worse, but mine is next. Dionysus, god of joy, has been just but too cruel. He was born of my blood, and he has destroyed my house. Agave. How ill-humored old age makes a man. How he scowls at me. I wish that my son were a great hunter like his mother, pursuing wild beasts with all the young men of Thebes, but he can only fight against gods. Father, you must reason with him. Let someone call him here before me to see my good fortune. Cadmus. Oh, my daughters, if you come to understand what you have done, how terrible your suffering will be. But if you remain always as you are now, though you could not be called happy, at least you will not know your own misery. Misery? What is wrong? Where is my cause for misery? First, turn your eyes this way. Look at the sky. Notice the technique of remembrance. Look at the sky. Why the sky? Because the sky has no image other than its own blue openness. One of the esoteric attributes of the mystic in divine rapture is that one is sky clad. There's a beautiful way of presenting it in Walt Whitman in his religious incantation, "By Blue Ontario's Shore." You can read it for yourself sometime. You see a beautiful statement of this mystical experience. The sky is the healer. The blue sky without any image whatsoever. If one is trapped in a compulsion of being magnetically pulled to some image by looking at the sky, when that dynamic is operative, can you fall into the sky? You say it doesn't happen. And what happens is then it sobers one up. Incidentally, it works physiologically. If you're ever seasick, if you lay on the deck and look at the sky, even though your body is heaving, if the eyes focus and the mind focuses on the unmoving sky, the seasickness will go away. The seasickness is a mental image and not a physiological reaction, it turns out. Although you wouldn't believe it if you were seasick. So she looks at the sky. Kadma says, "First turn your eyes this way. Look at the sky." She says, "I am looking. Why do you tell me to look at it?" Kadma, "Is it still the same? Or does it seem to you to have changed?" She says, "It is brighter than before, more luminous." Kadma, "And this madness you suffered from, is it still with you?" "I do not know what you mean, but I feel a change in my mind. My thoughts are somehow clearer." Cadmus, "Can you now hear and answer clearly?" Agwe, "Yes. I have forgotten what we said just now, Father. Notice how that when memory comes in at the last time that coherence was happening. It isn't what that one remembers the last moment necessarily. If the last moment is fevered, coming to in the memory, one remembers the last coherence. It always happens. Where have I been? What have I been doing? It's like one comes to, but one comes to in the last contiguous moment of time in its movement. This is true regardless of how much actual events have occurred, how much colloquial time has gone on. It can be years. It can be decades. Or like Pablo Neruda in the Heights of Machu Picchu, he says, "Come and thrust your anger and anguish into me. I will receive all your daggers." And look, the shadow of the condor survives us all this while. She says, "Yes, I had forgotten what we said just now, Father." She recognizes him. "Cadmus, when you were married, whose house did you come to?" He's taking her back. Classical therapy. He's resetting the consciousness in remembered time. It's the very process that Marcel Proust, in such great exquisiteness, was up to in A la Recherche du Temps Perdu. The past becomes recaptured through remembering and becomes real then. Just because the events were happening doesn't make them real. Just because you are making events happen, that is not real. But by remembering them confers their reality upon them. Then they are real. "When you were married, whose house did you come to?" "You gave me to Echion, who was said to have been sown in the ground. Then Echion had a son born to him. Who was he? Pentheus, my son, and his father's. Yes. And whose head is that you hold in your arms? A lion's, or so the women said who hunted it. Now look straight at it. It is not much trouble to look. She looks at the head in silence and then cries out. Oh, what am I looking at? What am I holding? Notice here that the function of memory is the cure for the overheated imagination. Notice that the imagination is appropriate in the natural ecology of meaning. But that natural ecology of meaning doesn't transpose intact into consciousness. There's a symbolic change, a symbolic transformation, so that consciousness does not fit into that natural ecology. Consciousness, if left to its own procedures, will dissolve the myths and say they are lies, will invalidate the rituals and say that they are cages of limitation, will question nature and say, what is the true situation here? What's the structure? It's like the beautiful statement of Jacob Bronowski in The Ascent of Man. He says, the mind has a cutting edge in the hand. And when the hand works from the mind's perspective, man can change nature, even change the structure of nature through the power of his mind. Can change the ritual level, can change the mythic meaning. But if the mind is not strong enough to do this, then the natural ecology personified by Dionysius will seek to reabsorb and bring down from one's high horse that consciousness, seeing it as a protagonist. This is very often presented in Christian and Jewish cosmology as the Satan, the adversary, the proud one, the arrogant one, the accuser, the disturber of the natural order, God's natural order. Too much conniving, private plans, you see. Not so much a fallen angel, but an angelic power that's gone out of nature into his own control, fallen into one's hubris. So it's a kind of a difficult thing. You have you have the same thing in Mahayana Buddhism, the notion of a preta, a hungry ghost, is a psychic entity which subsists outside of the natural balances, outside of the natural order. How so? Because it has accepted the delusion of self to such an extent that it occurs with certainty in this world of delusion on the basis of its own delusory capacity. Yes, the preto will be non-existent when this world will become non-existent, but as long as this world is extant to you, so will the preta be. So the only thing you can do is feed the hungry ghost. Food is set out. All over Asia, you still find this. It's not a cure at all. The membrance, the cure for it, is to go into that experience of the deep self, into the very core of the psyche. Because at that core of the psyche is the source of the projection in the first place. And when it doesn't occur, those tensions no longer happen. And then it's, as it said, it's as if it never had been. And the classic characterization by the Buddha is that there's nothing to talk about. Not only is it not intelligent to try and characterize this, but the right tact is to not even discuss it. These complications are only ephemeral and have no bearing. They're not worth discussing. That's a very high-toned, noble way of expressing it. But for us, in our comportment, we have suffered so much by this that we still want to reserve for ourselves the right to talk about it. Even when we have emerged somewhat from the devastating tensions, we would still like to work it over and say, what was that? What was going on? And some of it from the noble aspiration of helping others, helping loved ones and others to come out of that. Notice here that art is extremely important in this process. The therapeia is in the art. Art is not an object of intellectual aesthetic doctrine. Art is an expressive occurrence of the deep self in all of its capacity in actual life. A work of art exists not in an aesthetic horizon of judgment, but in life. A work of art is as real as any natural occurrence in life. To mistake art for an aesthetic level in life is a very grave error. It's incidentally an error which a great many people have fallen to. Soren Kierkegaard, the great existentialist, never was an artist in the sense that he was able to remember and recognize, although his journals, the journals of Soren Kierkegaard, are artistic as a whole, but he shied away from recognizing that and consequently saw the aesthetic as a level which one had to mature from. And that maturation, of course, in Kierkegaard is very, very, very difficult to sustain. It's not sustainable in Kierkegaard's sense. What the best that comes out of that is the poignancy of the existential quandary. The best that can happen from that standpoint is to live with the anguish of existence. Here's Bohra again, and we'll end with this and then go to our sculptures. This is on the bottom of page 222 from that. We'll have to go to the... the bottom of 220, we'll have to start there. It is poetry which is to change the world. The spirit of song or of music which is to create new societies. They have thus found a place for themselves and solved the discord which the original symbolists felt between themselves and the public. The poet, it is now felt, can do something that other men cannot do. He can give a special kind of life through his art. He can show what things really mean in their associations and relations. Through the feelings and the imagination, he creates an effect which science never can. The scientist is the mere expositor, the poet, the man of action. The magical conception of poetry has taken different forms. When Henri Bremond said that poetry was like prayer, he touched on something near the truth about the post-symbolists. For not only is their poetry an incantation, it is based on the belief that the poet is in touch with some superior order of things, and that his art is the ritual by which this is brought down to men. Rilke's theory of death and transformation, Gheorghe's cult of Maximin, Bloch's spirit of music, Yeats's spiritualism, are all attempts to make a religion out of the creative process which lies behind poetry, defined in its dynamic manifestations of power at work in the whole universe. Even Valéry's acceptance of poetry as something unique and inexplicable, and his unceasing surprise that such a thing can exist, are an admission that there is a mystery somewhere. And skip to the bottom. The magical view of poetry gives a special place to the poet. He is once again the vates, it's a Roman term, which Virgil popularized of himself. Once again, the vates, the instrument of unseen powers who work by superhuman methods. He is no longer a man among other men or expected to think the common thoughts of his time. In consequence, he is free, as he has seldom been, to be himself, to develop his individuality and private tastes. The aristocratic and autocratic tendencies of Gheorghe and Yeats are as much a reflection of this as are Bloch's obedience to his emotions and Rilke's refusal to identify himself with any country or movement or school. All feel that they must follow their own inclinations and be free to do what they choose. Otherwise, their powers would be hampered. And this independence is by tacit consent. Tacit means by silent affirmation. By tacit consent, allowed to them. They are even respected for it. It is because they are unlike other men and have a peculiarly personal view of life that they are listened to. What counts is the uniqueness of their work. And it goes on, but we'll stop there. What counts is the uniqueness of their work. The difference here in this particular educational cycle is that instead of being a poet or a sculptor or an architect or a musician to create a work of art, we are involved in the entire panorama to create a person. Which person? That person which we will be if we do this. The art of person making. That's what this is all about. Is that person real? If that person remembers the spiritual value of the deep self, that person is real. What is that spiritual value of the deep self? That focus has occurred by the integration of all of these lines going back to nature in its broadest base, related to us and conveyed and interiorized by the way in which we actually live, the way in which we actually do things, the way in which language flames out of that actual activity into a presentation of meaning in that symbolic integration, and the sense that it doesn't come to a point which is static, but rather that kind of Euclidean Pythagorean point, a point of no dimension, an openness, so that the person becomes real, not as a mask is real, by the firmed limitation, but becomes real by the realization of the openness of all of the divine possibilities that are all actual. And by remembering that, one will be whatever one will be. And in that way, man is made personal in the image of the divine. The image of the divine that has no limitation. Now, you could see that this is, if you put it into ideational terms, it's pretty highfalutin. But the task that we have is not to make some brilliant idea comprehensible to ourselves, but to participate in this very process by which we understand that the deepest personal includes an openness to those spiritual dimensions that occur before us, within us, and beyond us. And that we allow for those winds to blow through us is a part of our health. That we don't try to stop them up or bag them in any particular way is a part of our health. One of the great qualities of the real person is they allow for those spiritual dimensions to continue through them to wherever they're going to go. And so art becomes, as we would say, creative, has this creative dimension. The work of art does not stop at the work, but continues to create its values as long as there is someone to play with it, someone to interact with it. Every time Beethoven's Sixth Symphony is performed and one gets this glorious sense of nature transformed to cosmos, the tunes of those birds from the Vienna woods are transformed all over again in work, even though the birds have been dead for 175 years. In that sense, art is eternal. Every time that it is, it works. So we're trying to appreciate that, and we're trying to do this with the great emendation. How do you know when a work of art is finished? The great problem. A work of art is finished when the artist sets it aside and gives it its independence, frees that work. Now, our sculpture assignments have been germane to try and realize this very problem. I want to come to the sculpture now, and then I want to collect whatever haiku you have, and I have more Xerox paper. Thank God in the form of Dolores. And I will Xerox and give you more haiku pamphlets next week. And next week when you come, during the break, for the first 10 minutes of the break, I would like us all to stay together, and during the break to go outside with pencils and paper, and just walk around the garden together and do some spontaneous haiku in that experience. Then we'll collect all of these things together and make a pamphlet for ourselves. There'll be three levels of haiku. There'll be the haiku from your own private experience starting from scratch. There'll be the collection of haiku that I make today that's from an informed opinion on haiku. And next week, there'll be the spontaneous generation from the actual participant experience level. Those haiku should display the moraine marks of those increasingly real experiences. Maybe not individual haiku, but all of them together as a collection. There should be three different phases of haiku: good, better, best. So I'm going to do that for you next week, and that'll be the culmination of the poetry assignment. Then we'll turn towards our masks and our painting. Let's start with the bird. Let's see if a real bird comes in again, like last week. Dan, you weren't here. Toshi made this bird out of papier-mâché. It was placed on the stool, and the wind was blowing a little bit, and it started bobbing. And Gustavo said, "The bird is moving." And as soon as he said that, a real bird came in through the window, was flying around the room, exactly at that moment. Okay. Gustavo, please.
Well, more than thinking about it, I felt that background to the bird allowed me to bring some vibration to where the bird was flying. And I really didn't think about it much, because I was in an expressive mode. And that's what came out.
Have you ever seen expressive forms in this way before? Do you recognize this from any cultural levels of artistic heritage, cultural experience? Have you ever seen anything like this before? Do you know that once it was a dominant expressive mode of a whole civilization? Did you know that?
The word itself?
No, the way that you treated it.
No, I didn't. I wasn't really thinking about it.
Yeah.
I don't realize it.
Maybe I should get an example out while we're looking at it.
Better example at the moment. Now I know everything seems to be floating against that back.
Yeah, that was the artistic characteristic expressive mode of Mahayana Buddhism from the 3rd to the 7th century AD. But unfortunately, the center of that civilization was in Gobi Desert and was hidden from view for over 1,000 years and not discovered until the 20th century. It's very interesting because if one's acquainted with that, the way in which you have handled form and color is characteristic of that particular view. And I'm sure that you're not particularly Mahayana Buddhist in your insights. This came out of you from a natural advantage. But it's interesting because the theme of it, the seed of this, was the bird made by Toshi, who certainly has that deep Mahayana seed in her psychic self, most certainly. But it's your artistic capacity and excellence that you took the theme and expressed it in like kind. So that's what I'm saying. You made flourish a seed in a way which is appropriate to it, but Toshi put all of those qualities into that seed in the first place. But otherwise, there's no way that can come. You didn't know that about the style. You didn't know this was a style. This is the, they call it the Dunhuang style, because the caves that were found were in Dunhuang, China. The Dunhuang style from the 5th century AD in China. Now I'm sure that Toshi did not consciously put that there, but it was such a characteristic part of her deep self that it was there. And because it was there, you were able to bring it out. So it's a great example of the integrity of deep self. You see that the artist has confidence that he can put the most sublime into the work, and all of that sublime will come out regardless of whether somebody thought they understood or not, or whether they had any cultural affinity or not. It's a peculiar thing, but art is universal. We can understand Basho, We can understand Euripides. We can understand Kandinsky. We don't have to be Greek or Japanese or Russian. It's the fact, it's like a fact that the deep self is shared among us. Shared among us. We have access to it. Art is the accurate record that access is true. This is what I'm wishing to say. Can you see how important art is? Go on then. Did you begin with pasting it to the blank canvas? How did you begin?
No, actually, I was just painting the white. And while I was doing that, I had really not many words to explain. I just felt that it was right to apply the word some way. And as the primer was fresh, I just
I'm going to set it aside like that other sculpture because it's a great example of how this actually occurs. So Toshi, when you look at it, how do you experience it? You see the white moving upward. The colors moving. Moving upward like flames. Please.
When you brought that out last week and set it on the table, there was so much life to that, just the gracefulness of the paper, the way you set it up in the spring, it was alive on the stool there. And I loved the way it moved, and when you put the folded piece of the violet paper in there, it just added more to that. I was just watching it kind of dance. And when you first set it down, I said, oh no, you know, where's the dance? But I could see it, you know, in the lines, you know, around it. So you've taken that and, allowed it to dance, with the other colors. How do you feel about that? Does it feel good to be taken from that?
It's interesting because it's movement, as we would say today, on a molecular level. In fact, you've come down to like the molecular colors, complete with their complementaries. I think that if my eye is in that dark purple is a complement to the orange. I believe that they occur together. And that the green is a complement to the red. So you're dealing with molecular color here, but in a wholesome way, including the complement and the quaternary. And by virtue of that, the white is also moving. The background also is sinuous. Sinuous because the resonance between the colors also occurs. The relation between the colors in the resonance occurs in the white background, so-called, but it also moves. It took 500 years of meditation experience for the Zen Wang style to evolve in Mahayana art.
He was the product of half a millennium of meditative excellence. But it's interesting to see, you know, it's accessible. It's very accessible. Once the key is there, it's accessible. Let's move to another piece. How about the yellow arches, the McDonald's arches? Oh, excuse me, not the McDonald's arches.
I did not want to return the people to their original source. but to bring them forward, of course, doing that and then creating something else would be playing God in a sense. And I did not want to disturb the people as people because that's what they became to me. I thought of them as beginning people, primordial people. I did not want to paint them because if you paint a person's skin, they cannot breathe and this would kill them. So, and therefore, I wanted to leave them in the original color, and that presented a problem for me, what color to work with. I wanted to have them outdoors and to make grass or shrubbery or greenery would be too busy. So I decided to use the yellow because I also wanted to bring light to them. So I propped them up from underneath so that they would be to me more lifelike. They are there with their leader. They now have a leader who is, I changed their position, their hand and leg position a little bit to conform with the way that I saw them. The leader has at least one hand out because he's showing them and speaking to them. The leader is the only one that has a face. The leader has eyes and something of a nose and a mouth because he's speaking. The ones in the back do not have faces yet. They're just there, and some of them are very resistant. A couple of them are very resistant. They're not listening, but nevertheless, they are there. The ones in front have ears because they are beginning to hear, but no eyes because they do not yet see. I could not, of course, have a little one outside trying to climb in. Or she, if you're also with ears listening. I first put the halos on their head, but that didn't seem right to me. I wanted it to show that the light is there, but they're not aware of it. It is coming down to them, so I raised the halos that way. Oh, and then I wanted to give a suggestion of enclosure, not to leave them bare, but to give them a little bit of
canopy.
Of security. The canopy effect was what I wanted. I first envisioned it solid, but that didn't look right. It was too obscuring, even two or one-sided wasn't that good, so I just left it that way. I wanted to lift them up and to give them some enclosure.
Like a booth.
So that's just good.
You made a lot of conscious decisions about this. Did you do that while you were making it or before?
Most of it before. I considered a lot of settings for them. For example, the merry-go-round of life, put them on carousels type. Put them on a boat traveling through life on the prow of a boat, on a mountain going up a mountain. I just decided on this. And then once I decided to have them in an outdoor setting and together rather than just in a circle, to put them this way and then from there.
How does it feel to you, John, when you look at it? Put the idea aside for a second, the idea. What's the feeling, John, that you get from the work?
Well,